Hey, welcome to the Morning Mic Check. I'm Pat Brown here with Mike Metzger. Mike and I have known each other for a while now. I first met him around 2010, and he's become one of the key mentors in my life. Over the years, we've had countless conversations, and in almost every one, I've walked away having discovered something new. Mike has this unique ability where he can reframe a conversation, and you begin to discover a deeper reality around you. It's a bit like Alice tumbling down the rabbit hole. I'm releasing these conversations as an invitation to follow me as I go down that rabbit hole. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
It's a good start to the day here. Nice. Not bright, but early. We spent a good...
We've always been called that.
That's right. We spent a good time, good chunk of time last week talking about business values. And you mentioned something towards the end of the conversation about family. And the takeaway I got from our conversation last week was that if we're talking about business values and trying to shape culture, it's really, really hard to do that. And a key prime way to make everyone aware of the cultures through our gills, the 150 years worth of brackish water, as you put it, was to draw an image of success. And that's a really, really effective way to kind of put people off guard for a minute and get to maybe a more clear understanding where we're getting away from the traditional notions of I'm just going to use this language because I think this is what the person's looking for. So that was really helpful for me. What you said at the end was that the family may understand human nature better than your business. And we talked about the cottage industry and the return of the cottage industry, and I find it fascinating, particularly amidst our time now where everyone is working remotely. And so I figured it'd be fun to talk through that. And if you wouldn't mind giving just a primer for, as you've said, we're sort of seeing the return of the cottage industry. What does that mean?
Yeah, that's a good question. In a nutshell, prior to the Industrial Revolution, most work was done out of the home. And so we have what are called work was considered a cottage industry. So that's what they mean by the phrase cottage industry. So that's what the Industrial Revolution, roughly late 1700s to the early 1800s. And the big shift in the Industrial Revolution is that men, rather than working out of the home, went to work in what Blake, in his famous poem, Jerusalem, went to work in the dark satanic mills. And so work was often, factory work was filthy. It was often dangerous. And that's where the word for criminal activity or robbery was applied to work. And work became, for many people, it became a job. So you've heard of a bank job. That's a phrase, if you rob a bank job. So work began to be called a job. I've got a crummy job here. And what it was doing is just robbing men, primarily men, of what of a lot of the joy that work used to be. So that's what we mean by it was a cottage industry.
Sure. And so we're suddenly seeing now with the pandemic, all of a sudden, anyone who can work from home is now working from home, which is pretty wild. And so you have a lot of companies that were maybe not into remote work before or didn't think it was feasible, and now are being forced to operate in that model. And many have seen that work. I think it's pretty wild that they've just figured out a way to make it work. So In your mind, what is the benefit of that? What's the benefit of the return of the cottage industry? Is that just a interesting phenomenon? Is that beneficial? How do you see that?
Well, it's a mixed bag, but I think overall it could be very beneficial. Now, I'm pretty biased. I think if I do the math here, after college, so I've probably worked over four decades now, and I think, if I'm correct, all but three I've worked out of my home. I think 3 years I worked in an office. I had 1 9-month stint in an office in D.C., Washington, D.C. So for me, that's always the way I've worked. I've done a lot of startups, been an entrepreneur, so on and so forth. Never been particularly drawn to the office in the first place. So I think there's a couple of phenomena that take place. The first is fascinating little book years ago by Hetrick called The Russians. And it's the history of Russia. And most on few people understand Russia is not the Soviet Union. It became the Soviet Union for a period of about 70 years. But that 70 years was enough to drain away from a lot of Russians this sense of industriousness and the rich heritage of Russians. And so you can get used to being a subjugated people. And so now the joke is Russians throw one czar off for another. They're always looking for some kind of leader that's going to make all things work and work well. And in the same way, you can get used to working in office work such that you just think that's the way we always worked. And so I want to get back to the office. And so you're always going to have some are going to find home working from home uncomfortable, unusual, not what they're used to. And that's because it's just not a habit. It hasn't been a habit for a lot of people, especially for the last 100 years. But a couple of studies suggest, for example, 60% of people working from their home right now find themselves to be as productive or more productive than they were working in the office. If you're all about productivity, or you're largely about productivity, what would that tell you in terms of your office?
Say that again. If you're all about productivity.
Yeah, if your company is, you know, primarily is saying we have to have we want to maximize shareholder return by being maximum productivity.
Oh, right, right, sure. Then you should be home more.
You should be home more.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So I know. So that's what I mean by it's fascinating because what this pandemic has done is. If you hold, for example, if you take a squishy ball and if you squeeze one of these squishy balls, you see you flatten one part, but the other part bulges out. And in the same way, by flattening the curve, other curves all of a sudden really bowed out up and the down. So in other words, if retail was on the decline, which it was, brick and mortar retail, and a lot of the old legacy stores, JCPenney, Sears, Neiman Marcus, what the pandemic did is it accelerated what would have been perhaps a 20-30 year decline in brick and mortar retail. All of a sudden it's just boom, it's gone up and down, and the decline is suddenly very steep, and all of these old line firms are filing bankruptcy. Well, there was a decline, an emigration already underway from Silicon Valley in New York City prior to the pandemic, and now that's accelerating it. So I noticed that 2 weeks ago, Mark Zuckerberg, CEO of Facebook, announced that in 10 years, this was a plan they were already underway, but now this pandemic has accelerated. They hope in 10 years to have 50% of their workforce to be working remotely. Part of that was expedited by the cost of living in and around Silicon Valley. But second, I think there was read an article about a woman. She wanted to move. She wanted to live in Salt Lake City. So she relocated there, works for Facebook, and she's more productive. In fact, now that I think about it, JetBlue started this way. So this is long before, obviously long before the pandemic. But JetBlue initially had all of its booking agents started by a man of the Mormon faith, and he wanted to give meaningful employment to Mormon women. And so JetBlue even though the office was in New York City, they worked on folding tables. They were a lean startup, but all their booking agents were Mormon mothers wearing headsets who would do everything online from their home while they're raising their kids and working in and around the home. Theory being, you can do two things at once. Huh. And so it's just a hot industry when you think about it. So the pandemic has accelerated some trends, and a trend meaning if they're in decline, it is accelerating. It is accelerating the emigration from New York City. We're reading about all sorts of millennials fresh out of college. They all want to live in Brooklyn. Gosh, who doesn't? And next thing you know, this young woman, she's doing her work, living with her parents in Columbus, Ohio again, and she finds the savings of over $2,000 a month, first of all, is pretty significant. Mm-hmm. And second, reconnecting with some friends. And third, she's more productive.
Man, that's wild. Yeah, there's Jason Fried, I believe is his name, has a book called Rework. He started a company called Basecamp, originally 37 Signals, I think, but now called Basecamp. And his entire company has been remote for years. I mean, they definitely were leaders in that regard. And he spends a lot of time just talking about these quote-unquote principles of business and how contrary they are to how his business actually operates. And they see tons and tons of productivity, and it's pretty wild. And now, again, to see everyone forced into that is fascinating.
Yeah, it is. Meg Whitman, when she either came to the helm of eBay or what launched eBay, I can't remember. But, you know, with their senior team could live anywhere they wanted in the world.
Wow.
And they did. So that's what I mean by it's just fascinating when we think of a cottage industry. Now, again, just so we don't give this Pollyannish view of history. When the Industrial Revolution began to hit, you have to remember that almost three quarters of the world's population, the working population, worked in slavery or in forced servitude. So for most, work was not fun. So you have a quarter of the population has some autonomy or control over their work situation, and those you have the majority of them are working out of their home. The Industrial Revolution then took that percentage and created this divide between work and home that had not existed up until that point. So first of all, we want to at least be clear, it wasn't this, like you watch Downton Abbey, you go, gosh, everybody, work is so much fun.
Right.
Work was just crappy. It was worse than crappy. But the Industrial Revolution did accelerate. People could earn, and you had the beginning of a great increase in affluence. But you also have then, if you move away from cottage industry, you have efficiencies start to come in. Efficiencies are if you have 100 working in a factory, you can create mass production started. And you also have by the 1930s, you had the rise of what's called the corporation. A lot of this accelerates after, in the United States, the Civil War. And the Civil War unleashes these great technologies, as war often does. And so coming out of that, you have the rise of not only that, but not only the rise of corporations, but you have the rise of large multinational corporations like Standard Oil, which is called Standard because they standardize all these processes. But in standardizing them, they're now saying to the Pat Browns of the world, rather than you create in your home, you're going to become a widget. In the machine, sort of what Charlie Chaplin displayed in his famous that clip from that movie, but it begins to feel in many ways dehumanizing or a job. And again, with the rise of the personal computer and what have you, and the social technologies, we are seeing it's been forced upon us to work from your home. We know also about 47% of the workforce, I think, is the percentage. Their work is conducive to working from home. There's a lot of work that is not conducive, restaurant workers, and obviously, and there's whole segments that it's not conducive to this. But in the same way, if you have a restaurant and you've got 20 plus people work for you, you have a great little restaurant in a town, that's similar. That's not that far away from a cottage industry, because it has more of a family feel.
Sure.
So part of what we talk about, what we wanted to talk about last week, and we might have blurred it for some people or didn't clarify, is with the rise of the corporation and the loss of cottage industry, this coincides with also the loss of what has often been called by many the sacred canopy. That is, that all work was done under God, and all work is essentially good. And the point is to work well, not to do good. It's to do well in your work. And with the loss of that, it's Nietzsche, the famous writer who said God is dead. But Nietzsche didn't feel that atheists were honest, because if God is dead, then there's no morality and no meaning in life. And furthermore, as we mentioned earlier last week, Gertrude Himmelfarb wrote about, there are no virtues, because virtues are tied into a transcendent God. And so, in other words, these things are right no matter what the culture, no matter what the age, no matter what the system, no matter what the gender, no matter what the nationality. And when you lose all that, when all that collapses, Nietzsche said, all you're left with, and get this, Nietzsche coins this term, values. And values are just sort of horizontal things between people and nations. And so it's just fascinating to me that corporations and even the church has been the water going through the gills again. So they don't even think about it. So churches say we have our values, and corporations say we have our value statements, or we have 9 values. And what they don't understand is there, it's a language that is, it's not what cottage industry is. It's not even the way you talk at home, because you would never say to your wife, hey, we're having dinner at 6. Well, that's your value. That's not my value. I mean, Maddie would look at you and say, you knucklehead, what are you talking about? Where'd you get this strange language? Well, right over there, Maddie, if you look on the wall, we have 9 values that we hold here. She goes, when did that get put up on the wall? Well, it's right over here next to our lengthy mission statement. She starts to read it. She goes, was that cobbled together by a committee? And you say, well, actually it was. Most mission statements are cobbled together by a committee in a corporation. They just don't. It's just not the way you talk when you're at home.
Yeah. So why is that important? I picked up on that distinction last week and I had trouble kind of deciphering. So what? It is different than home. I get that. That's clear as day. But what does that mean? What are the implications of that? Does that mean it's a pointless endeavor in the office because it's different at home? Like,
no, so I think what it means is people don't feel at home at work. How do you behave when you feel at home with someone?
Definitely more natural, more free,
right.
Open. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. If you have a great marriage, you feel at home with that person.
Yeah.
If you love God with all your heart, soul, strength, your mind, you feel at home with Him. And He feels at home with you. So I lament, and what I understand that the 99.999% of men and women in business are going to go, what planet is this guy from? Because you don't feel it, you don't feel at home. By that, I mean you take on edited behaviors. Now we call them, well, that's being professional. That's a false dichotomy. Professional, do you know where that word comes from?
I do not.
Sure you do. It meant to profess something. It literally comes out of the medieval guilds, informed by the Christian faith, that we're doing work as it ought to be done. We're professing what work ought to be.
Oh,
Today,
wow.
professional means high paid, highly paid, highly educated people with various degrees, so doctors, lawyers, CEOs, they are professionals. Now, I understand when they say, we want you to act professionally. I get it. Professionally means, respect and, not coming in with a torn t-shirt and sweatshirt like you're wearing now because, sweatpants because you're working from home. I get it. But why are people wearing shorts and a nice shirt now for Zoom at home?
Yeah.
Because a lot of people love wearing shorts. They're at
Yeah.
home.
Yep.
And unfortunately, what we've created is a world that's only affordable for a select few. So Richard Branson can say, I want to live in an island. And I want to work from a hammock. And, Jimmy Buffett got this thing wired better than most. I think Buffett, I don't know how many hits he's had, but he basically, this is the way I want to dress. And what he's professing is, this is where I feel at home. So that's how I'm going to work. Now, anybody want to say, well, Jimmy, you just haven't been that productive. Well, I would say for what he aimed to do, you can say, Richard Branson, you just haven't been that productive.
Right.
eBay, not that productive. Tony Hsieh, I believe is the name. He tried to do this with Zappos a few years ago and then found that people were so habituated to being managed that he had to back off. But he had learned at this conference about this idea that workers don't need to be managed and tried to reduce all levels of management. And they had, a percentage of the workforce and within the first few months quit. Now, back then, people wouldn't do that right now in a pandemic. But he was trying to, in a way, return work to what you would do at home. Do you have a manager in your home, Pat? You come home and say, "Manager." You might feel that way if you
I
come in, the place looks like a mess.
was
Okay, that's a bad example. Bad example makes bad law. But he was sort of putting feelers out there to say there's something about this. You feel more human. You feel more at home. Now I grant you can get habituated. You can get used to the ball and chain as the Soviet Union did. But even then, you have inside the Soviet Union writers like Solzhenitsyn who are suggesting this is inhumane. That we have forgotten. This is not the way humans were designed to be. But you really are a lone voice in the wilderness if it goes on long enough. And so I understand, in a way, we're a lone voice in the wilderness to remind people of this great divide, pre-industrial revolution and post. Now, by the way, I stole that phrase, the Great Divide, from C.S. Lewis. And when Lewis, he was an Oxford Don, D-O-N, Don, for about 30 years, where he was also, that's where he went to college, went to university. But because of his popularity, it's felt, even though he was popular amongst many professors, popular professor speaking out on Christianity. So eventually they never offered him a professorship at Oxford, but Cambridge did. So he continued to live in the kilns with his brother Warney, but he commuted. Now he drove up to Oxford. And his first lecture, when it was broadcast on the BBC, I believe, it was turned into a public address, was titled The Great Divide. And what Lewis was talking about is, as he put it, somewhere around the time of Jane Austen's Persuasion, 1816, marks the Great Divide. And what Lewis was saying was, prior to this early 1800s, the world was very different than this world today. Now, by the way, he uses that to talk about another great divide that Christians don't recognize, very few do, that prior to that time, you had mostly what were called pagans, and he that wasn't a pejorative term. It simply meant these are people who really hadn't heard. But as he pointed out, they say he's the first one to coin this term. After that, you have the rise of post-Christians. Now, what's a post-Christian, Pat?
That'd be someone who's already heard and has moved on.
That's right. Post-after. Mm-hmm. So, been there, done that. And he can liken the post-Christian to a divorcee and the pagan to a virgin. And he said, but he felt that Christians, very few Christians recognize that. It's this great divide. That's fascinating because that's the same period of time that the modern evangelical church is springing up. And I happen to think that the most contemporary evangelical churches in America don't recognize this great divide either. They don't recognize what was like life before. What Lewis would say is really the full effect of the didactic enlightenment hits, and what is like life like afterward. And the same way, if it's almost like this mountain range, and all you see is everything this side of the mountains. And so Lewis was trying to alert people that we're in a post-Christian age, and it's everything, every way when you think about impacting pagans, you don't understand the world we're in. And the same way, I can appreciate that for most people in work, the work they see, they're on this side of the mountains. It's only 150, 200 years old. And they just assume this is the way work's always been. This is work. This is how we work. We go to work. We commute long hours. We sit in, I've seen your office, and we try to sort of dress them up, and we tried to do things which sort of emulate the home. I helped a company, and when they built their headquarters, we had a pub on the third floor called Inklings, stolen from Lewis and company and Tolkien, and the little pub they met in. I mean, what they call themselves rather, the group. But what you're really trying to do is you're trying to emulate aspects of the home. So what the pandemic has accelerated is all these various stabs over the last few years has accelerated the way work used to be for thousands of years. And so I think there's some good things that will come out of this, frankly, that will come out. There will be more people working remotely. There simply will.
Yeah. It's wild for me to think about how education plays into that. I mean, with the cottage industry, I imagine that speaks more to even apprenticeships and that whole piece of you kind of grow up into the family business. And without that, you have a lot more freedom, sure, but it also changes our education model and even our understanding of education. And so what's pretty wild to me now is to also see side by side with this return of the cottage industry, we have the educational system, which is now kind of like everyone is homeschooled, and I mean, that's mind blowing. I can't imagine a time where I ever would have thought that was a thing, you know, but here we are. So I'm really curious. Do you have any thoughts on just as we spend more time in the home, as we have people that are able to do that, and now we have education coming from the home, and I don't know, how do you make sense of that? Do you see any benefit there?
Oh my gosh, yeah. I mean, that would be a 12-hour podcast. my business partner is also a professor at a small college, and this is accelerated. Up in Baltimore, I believe the technical, it's the Institute of Notre Dame, private high school. I think it's been around for 100 years, closing its doors. They were in decline, but the pandemic just, they said, we give up. A couple of years ago, Sumner, he used to be the professor of Harvard, he and a group of researchers wrote a paper called The Coming Avalanche. I think you can get it online. So if any of you have an interest in education, well worth reading. I'll give you the summary, cliff notes. The Coming Avalanche. They were forecasting, I'm going to guess this is 10 years ago, that with the rise of online education, you're going to see an avalanche in tier 2, 3, and 4, tier 2 schools, tier 3, and tier 4. They're going to just get, you're going to see them disappear. And here's why. Put it in the simplest terms possible. So MIT, this is quite a few years ago now, put their first course online. They just threw it online for fun. It's free. Anybody could view it. I think it was just a one-time shot. They were surprised to find they had 100,000 views. What's going on here? So fast forward a bit with MOOCs and the rest, MOOCs, MOOCs and online and Audacity, all these various platforms. Georgia Tech. So last time I checked, if you want to know, Georgia Tech is a tier one school. Yeah, a tier one engineering school. You can get a master's from Georgia Tech online for about $6,000. Now let's just dream up a fictional tier three school. We'll call it Andy Granatelli Tech. And you can get there. He invented STP, for any of you who don't know. and you can get a master's. And you're living, let's just pretend it's a school in Albuquerque, and it costs on average $36,000. So let's just say you live in Ames, Iowa, Pat. Now you can relocate to Albuquerque, have to find a place to live, all your business moving expenses, and get your master's in engineering, mechanical engineering, for $36,000. Or you can stay right at home where you have all your friends and the rest and get a degree from Georgia Tech for $6,000 in mechanical engineering. And that sheepskin doesn't say you did it in your PJs from your bedroom.
It's a pretty good bargain.
Yeah. So they said there's going to be a coming avalanche. Tier 2, Tier 3, Tier 4 schools simply won't be able to compete. For example, when the Ivies begin to offer courses where you have an array of Ivy League professors and you can take these courses showing that you've done work at Harvard or Yale or Princeton, or you can do it at, I'm not going to actually name colleges because someone might have gone to these Tier 2, 3, and 4 and be insulted. I mean, I went to a tier two school, but, all of a sudden you hear all these clicks, by the way, all these people listen to podcasts. Well, I ain't listening to him anymore. that's what I mean by the avalanche.
Sure.
So what has the pandemic done? It's accelerated that. So, there are the number of colleges that have already announced they're closing up. There are quite a number scrambling to say, we're going to close the campus. Where do you get online? Uh-oh. So now you're competing against tier one schools. And even then, for example, a couple of weeks ago, Wall Street Journal had an article on this, and you have a young man who is finishing up his degree in Vanderbilt, but everything's going to be online. And he finds himself thinking, well, gosh, that's a whole lot of money. Maybe I ought to finish up, you know, local college or online somewhere else, because then this transferred out over, but gosh, that's a lot of money. Now, most will stick with Vanderbilt because it's a tier one, but there's a whole lot of tier two, three, and four, and they're private colleges, so they're smaller colleges, and it's just a whole lot of money. And you begin to go, so someone might say, I want to live, and name your spot, name your town. I want to live there. Or I used to work in a restaurant, and now this restaurant's been closed, and now, well, that's a bad example because you got this 19-year-old saying, and now I'm making a whole lot more money being unemployed than I worked at the restaurant.
Right, right. That's the thing. I know people who, yeah.
But maybe come June, I believe it's June 30th, Congress, that's supposed to expire. But as I think we joked last time, I mean, it's been a miracle. Up on Capitol Hill, they went behind the dome and they found out back in a parking lot this giant tree they'd never noticed before. And it's growing money. It's unbelievable. They named it manna because, and they find that if you pluck all the $1,000 bills off it every day, you come back the next day, guess what?
It grows back.
It's a miracle. And so they're spending money on Miracle-Gro and watering it, trimming all the trees around it so it gets daylight. So, all right, back to reality.
Well, so one of the things in my head that has always been kind of a break in my mental model, I am definitely a supporter of remote work. I've enjoyed doing that. I think it takes discipline. It's a different approach to work for sure. And if you're used to having a manager and doing what you're told, you probably won't enjoy it that much. But there is a difference between the home and the office. I get it. And people would say, well, you miss out some things about being in the office. I push back on that a little bit. However, with education, I do see that more obvious. I mean, there's, for better or worse, there is a different experience, college experience for sure, if you go away to college versus doing an online class or even local community and transfer in. I mean, I went to Maryland and, you know, it was clear you had people that were the 4 years, then you had the transfers, and then obviously you never saw the people taking it online. But there was even a difference between the transfer students and just their college experience. You definitely see it in high school and I guess the K through 12 with homeschool. I mean, socially, there's a very different experience, and that typically follows you through to as you grow up. You have a different social understanding. So I'm just curious, if we do shift more to that model, I mean, it makes sense financially. It does solve a decent amount of these tuition problems, but are we losing things if that's the path we're walking towards?
Well, I'm sure we are. I mean, there are trade-offs. I get it. I don't know. I just, Clayton Christensen, you know, who's written so many good books on, the innovator's dilemma, and he's fell out for the first time this model that disruption is the lifeblood of innovation. And, you know, if you're a Christian and listening to this podcast and you go, innovation, schminnovation, who cares? Innovation is the Latin translation of the Greek word renew. And if you're a Christian, especially if you're in a thick liturgical church, you're going to hear every Sunday the Colossians 1 passage that we are supposed to be about the renewal of all things. That would include education. So, first of all, there ought to be an ongoing innovation going on in education, and it's going to be disruptive to some degree, and it's going to have some head scratching of, I don't know. But the colleges, as they originally were founded, and the university, were far smaller than we have today. But I get your point about the socialization. Now, I know some people that homeschool, and they build these socialization networks. Mm-hmm. So that I just think one of the outcomes has got to be a couple of things are pretty sure bets. One would be, it would seem to me there are going to be more parents who are going to go, you know what, we can do this. We're going to start homeschooling. That will be one of those. There's going to be more people working remotely because they're going to find, hey, boss, I'm really more productive this way. We don't know what the percentage are, but you can see it's beginning to shift. By the way, unfortunately, I think you're also going to see more. You're going to see a spike in divorces.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And
I think we have in some situations.
Yeah. And then you're also you're going to see a spike in babies.
Mm-hmm.
And good for that. so much for the, you know, no more water cooler break. we don't know, but when it comes to education, Pat, I went to school, there were 25,000, at Western Michigan University, and I loved it, but I went to school in the mid-70s. And for some reason, it just feels a little different today. In other words, I loved that 4 years. I soaked it up. I soaked it up a bit too much my first year, and then grades came out. And then next thing you know, that was part and parcel with me. It's kind of a wake-up call. Next thing you know, I came to faith and turned my academic career around, just did a 180. But I don't know, somehow had a different feel back then. We were, it was the tail end of the 60s and the 70s, and it was just could you luxuriate in it? There was Free Speech Alley. There was all this coming together for all these things. The concert industry wasn't commercialized yet. And I don't know. I watch our three going through college, and I talk to a lot of people, and I don't hear them say, this is a great time in life. It's more of a, we're getting through so I can get out to get this degree. Yep. And then also if you come out saddled with $30,000 on average in debt, and of course we know people with a whole lot more than that, but I didn't come out with any debt. But if I recall correctly, it cost about, I think, $4,000 a year back then, $5,000. And I was on an athletic scholarship anyway, but I dropped it my senior year, paid my way through college the last year. It wasn't that difficult. I worked that summer, worked in a foundry, made good money, so on and so forth. Finished, I was debt-free. I'm sorry, I owed my parents $300, and I sold my Datsun. That's right. What do they call it now today? Nissan. I sold my Datsun for $300, stuffed it in my pocket. And believe it or not, with my degree, I hitchhiked home. I did. It was an hour and a half drive. It took about 3 hours to hitchhike. And funny story, I'm on Saginaw, Michigan. Remember Simon and Garfunkel saying it took me 4 days to hitchhike from Saginaw. Well, it took me about 4 hours to hitchhike to Saginaw from Kalamazoo. And it was, April or somewhere? And this snowstorm starts to hit. And it's so bad. Here I'm, freshly minted college graduate. I go to a service station, pull out a dime, call my dad, and say, Dad, would you come get me? And that's how the glorious graduate of Western Michigan with dual degrees in history and philosophy, hitchhiking home, but paid me up. And my parents' money, I was debt-free. And that's often not the case. It's increasingly not the case. So, where does this go? Well, debt was increasing. You have graduates of tier 2, 3, and 4 schools, especially in the recession of 12 years ago, who the studies show will never earn in accumulatively through their life's work what those pre-recession made. You're simply stepping into an economy that has yep. slipped. And now you're going to have that same thing happening now. And so the school across the street here used to cost $55,000 a year. I think the president, they dropped that price. But we had a couple of graduates, but when they were going through school, they came here to the house. We mentored them. But one of them just offhandedly one day said, you know, he's finishing up with $80,000 in debt, student loans. From a liberal arts, great books college, which generally means you're either going to go work, you're going to pull shots at Starbucks, you're going to work at a pub, or you're going on to grad school, which they did, and accumulated more debt. And if you're going to come out and be a professor, you know, at one time, on average, in many disciplines, a PhD, on average, 300 PhDs were pursuing one academic opening. Now, if you have the closing of colleges, that's only going to get worse. And so you might come out with $125,000 in debt, and you're going to start out at this college here. You start out at, I think, $50,000 a year. Well, if you're going to live in Annapolis and you're going to pay taxes in Maryland, you're going to be a long time paying off that debt.
Daunting.
Well, things, I think, just get easy to get twisted and warped, and you get used to them. And so, I'm not a big fan of how this pandemic has wrenched the economy. But in wrenching it, as opposed to what Sweden did, in wrenching it, has accelerated a lot of these trends. And it has pushed people back to work as a cottage industry. And it's not surprising to me that you have a percentage find themselves more productive. I'm not saying everyone ought to. I don't think that's possible right now. But it has certainly opened their eyes. And this would have been, I think, 20, 30 years coming. As I said, Facebook was already working on it prior to. And other companies have done it. And it can be done. But there's a whole lot of, you know, there's still a whole lot of boomers running the shows in a lot of places. And, you know, boomers are getting older and you're less inclined to make such a radical shift because that's just not the way we do work. And in fact, well, matter of fact, that is the way we can do work. You just have never gone up on the mountain and looked at this great divide and looked back and go, I've never even seen that before.
Yeah, that's fascinating to think. Again, I mean, you've said it before, but we often think of history as linear and progress as linear, and just to see this sort of cyclical nature of it, it's more we're not returning to what was the cottage industry, but we are returning to hints of it, and we are seeing this circle. It's really wild. I think it's a healthy perspective of history.
It is, and his name escapes me right now, but a great Jewish writer. And he was the one who noted what you just said, Pat, that he was saying that Judaism, but by extension, Christianity, is incompatible with the modern Western notion of progress, that everything goes forward, because the central dynamic in Judaism and in Christianity for centuries was the Hebrew word return. So if you read through the Old Testament, you find it all the time, even in the New Testament, return to me and I will return to you. So return was never a foreign notion until, again, this great divide. And on this side of the divide, history is linear. and it's always progressing and always going forward. C.S. Lewis said it well. If you find you're on the wrong path, the truly progressive person, just you turn around and you return to the right path. And so we were sort of kind of nudgings in some ways, because some of these paths in education, and even unsustainable meaning, about 20 plus years ago, J.C. Penney did a study. Their offices were in New York City, and they concluded that if you had to commute over an hour and a half, that we would eventually lose you. We couldn't retain top leadership. But they couldn't find a way to make it affordable, so they relocated to Texas. I can't remember which, maybe it was Dallas. But they were really just postponing what was inevitable. And inevitable was J.C. Penney just frankly didn't appeal to younger and younger people. For example, I hate to put you on the spot here, but do you shop at J.C. Penney?
No, actually. Do not.
No. Now, my mom loved JCPenney. My mom turned 90 yesterday. I can remember going there, but once I'm spending my money on clothes, I don't remember going there. And I distinctly remember going through Annapolis Mall one time and saying, gosh, this is like being in the 70s in Saginaw, Michigan, because JCPenney made some decisions to save money by no longer investing in keeping the stores fresh. Sears did the same thing. Sears filed for bankruptcy. JCPenney filed for bankruptcy. Neiman Marcus filed for bankruptcy. Now, Neiman Marcus is going to come out with this with fewer stores, and so will JCPenney. But it just postpones the inevitable. The inevitable is, it seems unlikely that X amount of years out, there will even be a JCPenney. There will even be a Sears. There might be bits and pieces in other little cottage industries. And in the same way, this pandemic is taking a whole lot of businesses and maybe pushing them back to having the Pat Browns of the world work more in a cottage industry, where you get these serendipitous moments with your family and your kids, and you find, business is kind of fun.